This is WMUK's West Southwest Brief. I'm Andy Robbins. What was life like in a colonial fort in southwest Michigan 300 years ago? Archaeologists from Western Michigan University are trying to find out. They and local volunteers have been digging at the site of Fort St. Joseph in Niles since 2002. Western Michigan University professor Michael Nasaney leads the work exploring the fort's history.
Yeah, so Fort St. Joseph was an 18th century French trading post that was established actually at the end of the 17th century, first by the Jesuits and then by the French crown. They constructed a palisade somewhere along the banks of the St. Joseph River. And I say somewhere because for a long time, nobody knew exactly where it was. And they proselytized the natives, and they engaged in commercial activities, and there was also a small military contingent, a garrison there. And they were there later, followed by the British, for almost a century, about 50, 60 people, essentially establishing their settlement and interacting with native peoples. And it is now an archaeological site. So there are no standing structures. There was nothing above ground that we could see, but beneath the ground, the signature of their daily activities is buried just beneath a thin layer of soil. And we've been investigating this site since really the discovery was in 1998, and the first full field season was 2002. And we've spent about 15 field seasons there now. We've identified the locations of houses, trash deposits, getting a sense of who lived in the houses. And this year is exciting. We're actually expanding out from the location we've been working to reveal even a larger evidence of the fort.
It was Western's team, including yourself, who actually found the actual location of the fort, right?
Yeah, it was in 1998. We were called by local people, support the fort, a group of history enthusiasts, and they said, help us find our French trading post. We agreed, unbeknownst to us. They didn't tell us they'd been looking for it for 100 years. So we showed up, and we do what archaeologists do. We dug lots of little holes. And with a little bit of luck, a local collector came by. He'd been working in an area that we probably weren't going to work because it was so wet. And he showed us a box that had 18th century artifacts in it. We went to that location. We dug more holes, found more artifacts. And as it turns out, the deposits are beneath the water table. So it's a very complex situation. And we actually have to lower the groundwater table every time we do the excavations. But we do that with local volunteers assisting. And it's been a great opportunity to learn about a place for which there was very limited historical documentation.
Now, having your artifacts underwater for a good part of the year sounds terribly inconvenient. But do you think that actually helped preserve them?
Well, I think partly what preserved the site was the fact that it was wet, and so people stayed out of there for the most part. It was essentially a swamp, and then later it was used, part of the area was used as a dump. So unlike places like Detroit, for example, where Fort Pontchartrain was, became part of urban Detroit, and so that 18th century site got built on. You know, and that's not an unusual situation. Michilimackinac is also sort of rare insofar as that area wasn't settled. So the water in some ways was a mixed blessing. As I said, it kept people away from there until archaeologists could get there 250 years after it was abandoned.
The Fort St. Joseph is sometimes referred to as the Fort of Four Flags, and you mentioned France and England, but the Americans and the Spanish had a hand in too.
Yeah, they did. So unlike some other places like Michilimackinac, where the British came in and had a major presence and restructured and expanded the fort, Fort St. Joseph remained, for the most part, a French post. The English were there for a couple of years until Pontiac's Rebellion. And then we sometimes refer to it as a footnote to history. It was actually a group of French and natives under the Spanish flag from St. Louis came up and claimed all of Michigan for Spain. So that was short-lived. They were there for about 24 hours. And, of course, it later becomes American territory. But the Americans never really ran it as a fort. The area, though, stayed important in fur trading activities into the 19th century, even before Michigan statehood, as it was part of the old Northwest Territory.
Now, they've passed now, but every summer some public lectures take place regarding the excavation of Fort St. Joseph. And this year, the theme for that was the importance of preserving the past for the future. How do projects like this accomplish that?
Yeah, so that is the theme, what we call curation, right? So that's maybe a fancy term that archaeologists, museum specialists use for essentially, as you said, preserving the materials, not only the materials we get out of the ground, but also the associated notes, and then making them accessible for future generations. So we're fortunate that we work closely with the Niles History Center, and they are the local repository. So they ensure that the artifacts and the associated notation and so forth are being preserved for future generations. So they're kept in a dry place with somewhat climate control, organized, cataloged in a way that they can also be, they can be accessed in essence. And this has now become a priority for us. It's not that materials were in disarray for the last 20 years, but we'd been focusing for a large part, to a great extent, on the recovery of materials. And now we realize that archaeological materials, if they lose their provenience information, then essentially they're just antiquities with really little research value. So we've just developed established a Fort St. Joseph archaeology curation fellowship, and my field director, Erica Hartley, is now the curation fellow. So that's a one-year position. We're hoping to extend it, again, to extend the life of this material. Otherwise, it's really just a bunch of trash.
So how do you turn something that prevent something from being just trash and being something that future historians and archaeologists can use?
Yeah, well, a lot of it is pretty stable. So, for example, we recover lots of animal bones. They're quite stable. Ceramics, glass, for the most part. A lot of metals are fairly stable, like copper alloy and lead. Probably the least stable are the iron artifacts that we recover. So what we try to do with those is we're trying to essentially get them to equilibrium. They've been in the ground, they come out of the ground, and they're shocked, if you will, because they're facing a new environment. And we try to stabilize them by really just dry brushing them, placing them in, like a good Ziploc bags, 4 mil Ziploc bags, and a good thick Ziploc bag, put little silica packets in them, and then try not to disrupt them too much in terms of changing temperatures and humidity and this sort of thing. And then in some instances, we'll probably need more specialized conservation techniques to ensure their preservation. Otherwise, they tend to rust and they tend to fall apart. So in addition, we don't really recover that much in the way of iron artifacts. I would say they maybe constitute, just a guesstimate would be maybe 1 or 2% of the materials we recover. So we're sort of fortunate in that regard. And as I said, the rest of the materials are fairly stable.
When I was there, I think 2 or 3 years ago now, saw some of the things that were being recovered. And there were things like, buttons, bullets, pieces of glass and ceramics like you mentioned. Often perhaps things people threw away because they didn't want them or need them anymore. But what can you learn about the past from something like that that people back then threw away?
Yeah, that's our stock in trade, right? It's other people's garbage. So we say the archaeological record is a product of people's activities, namely materials they lost, they abandoned, or they discarded because they're broken or something. So the kinds of information we can use, it's almost endless, almost just limited by our imaginations. For example, in the area we've been working, we have found buttons. So we can inspect these buttons and we can determine what kinds of clothing they come from. So we know, for example, there was a contingent of about 8 to 10 enlisted men, few officers and so on. They typically would have wore uniforms. The uniforms they wore had distinctive styles of buttons. So in the area that we're working, we found only about a handful of military buttons. So actually in this instance, sort of the negative evidence, the fact that we're finding so few of them suggests to us this is not where the military lived. So again, we don't have any detailed maps, descriptions, drawings of Fort St. Joseph. So we're literally reconstructing the map, determining where people lived on the landscape and what activities they conducted. Another example would be in the museum before we even started the archaeology, people had collected artifacts from plowed fields in and around the vicinity of Fort St. Joseph. They found lots of glass beads. So we have bags and bags of glass beads from previous collectors.
And glass beads were trade goods, mainly.
Yeah, they were objects that were very tiny. They were embroidered onto garments, for the most part, the small ones. Larger ones might have been used for necklaces, but mostly the small ones are used for embroidering onto moccasins and garments and so on. We've recovered them right in front of a fireplace in one particular area where there's a large concentration of them. So the context of those objects is telling us that, again, we've ruled out the military living in this house. So it's likely, and it's probably not the commandant or a priest, fur trader, fur trader's wife sitting in front of this fireplace and embroidering beads onto a garment. And these beads, sometimes just this small, they fall onto the ground, might not see them, might not recover them. There for the discerning eye of the clever archaeologist, right, to recover centuries later. And so those beads then that we find tell us something about what activity was taking place and where it was happening. Whereas the ones that lack provenience information, they lack locational information, are neat. They're old objects, but they're divorced now from that information.
Now, you're just out with a book, Fort St. Joseph Revealed. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this just came out a couple days ago, and I probably would have promoted it even more had I known when it was going to arrive. I didn't think it'd be here by the open house. But anyway, it's been time for us to, we've been publishing all along. We've been doing a booklet series, which is accessible to a general audience. Obviously, I write scholarly articles. My book on the fur trade also has a chapter on Fort St. Joseph. But here, this was a chance. We've had, maybe a dozen master's theses now that have come out of the project. So it seemed that this was an ideal situation to encourage my students to boil down their thesis into each of them into a sort of a readable chapter format, 20, 25 pages, and I co-authored with a number of them. And so the book contains information on the history of Fort St. Joseph, for sure, as well as various aspects of the archaeology. So the lead seals that were attached to the cloth and so on, and the markings on them and how they can be deciphered to tell us what kinds of cloth was coming to Fort St. Joseph. The locations of native settlements in the area. This was a study done by one of my students in the geography department, noticing that before Fort St. Joseph was occupied, people were fairly dispersed. When Fort St. Joseph is built, they all cluster to it, like it's a big Walmart or something, right? And then when Fort St. Joseph is abandoned, they actually go back to their old lifeways, interesting enough, and disperse again on the landscape. So, a number of different studies. We mentioned the fur trade. They were processing furs. One of the ways they were doing that was by using these little pits, just about maybe a foot in diameter, maybe a foot deep, and they're filling them with green corn and burning that corn and to create a smoky fire to tan these hides. And we found evidence of these pits in proximity to the fort. So again, this is telling us something about the kinds of economic activities that were taking place there. Also, there's information on the public archaeology dimensions of what we do. So without really community support, really the invitation from the community at the outset to get involved in the way that we try to reciprocate by involving people and disseminating information and so forth. So that's a critical component of what we do. And then the closing chapter is when I reflect on 100 years of interpreting Fort St. Joseph. And people think about Fort St. Joseph, of course, differently today than they did even when we started working, even midway through our war, even 10 years ago, and when we started working and at the beginning of the 20th century. So people have always used Fort St. Joseph as a place to think with, if you will, about themselves and their relationship to the colonials and their relationship to the natives and so on. And as social and political conditions, if you will, have changed, so too have those interpretations changed. So again, going back to curation, one of the importance of maintaining these collections is that the way we look at them now is not the way we'll look at them, we're certain, 10 or 20 years from now. They will speak to us in a different way because we'll just see them differently.
The book is accessible by someone who is not a trained archaeologist?
Yeah, it's somewhat technical, I would say, but I mean, I tend not to write in extreme jargon, so it is accessible, and it will be available in bookstores, I'm sure.
Where does the Fort St. Joseph project go from here? I mean, are you close to being done, or?
Well, always a good question. You know, we had in our lecture series the director of archaeology from Michilimackinac talking about how they curate their materials, and reminding us that the work there started in 1959, and they have excavated each and every year. We're catching up, maybe in some ways, insofar as we can. WMU is actually holding its 44th annual archaeological field school this year. Now, not all of those field schools have been held at Fort St. Joseph, but this is now one of the longest-running projects, one of the longest-running field schools now, if not the longest-running in the country. So we're about 20 years in. People ask me how much longer will it go on. There's easily another 50 years of work there. We have this year expanded into a new area of the site. People who come and visit this weekend, I think, will be quite pleased to see what we're finding now. And,
what kind of things are you finding now?
Well, in brief, we're digging beneath that dump. Right, that covered, we thought might cover part of the site. And the question was, when we went in, what's beneath it? And the short answer is evidence of 18th century life. So this potentially doubles the size of the fort area based on our investigation. So this is very exciting. And then the logistics of removing this 20th century landfill is another matter. But, you know, we often say between the water and the dump and the conditions there sometimes, Fort St. Joseph has not easily yielded its secrets, but they are being revealed.
Do you sense any irony in having to move aside modern trash to get to the old trash?
Well, you know, there's a tremendous interest in what's called the archaeology of the contemporary. So it's archaeological remains that were laid down within your memory, my memory, and it could be just sites that are still occupied today. So I had mixed feelings about actually digging through this with the backhoe. Sort of reminds me in Europe when they dig through the material from the Middle Ages to get at the Roman materials, if you will. But the dump was bulldozed, and it was already commingled and heavily disturbed. It's not to say there weren't some interesting artifacts that we observed. I mean, one of them was a little key to a sardine can that none of the students could identify. So, you know, objects like that. And there's plenty of the dump left if anybody wants to study that. So we haven't disturbed it all by any means.
Western Michigan University Professor Michael Nasaney is the leader of the Fort St. Joseph Archaeological Project. I'm Andy Robbins. Thanks for listening.